if you believe assault is an act, not an adjective. Your safety is not just on the gun, it is the gun. Freedom is a fundamental human right. Welcome to your show, Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes. What do you believe? Your safety is your responsibility, not the government's, not anybody else's. Be a citizen, not a subject. Better yet, be a listener. Because it's an inalienable right, not a privilege. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live, right now. Call 1-800-313-9443.
Good morning, everyone. I have to start the show with just a little bit of something here. There is a company referred to as the Freedom Group. And the Freedom Group just made it policy that no company workers under the entire Freedom Group banner can carry concealed or have firearms locked in their cars while at work. Okay? That's the Freedom Group. Now, the name Freedom would make you think otherwise. And if that doesn't make you think otherwise, let me list for you a few of the companies under the Freedom Group banner. You might be interested to know who these companies are. Remington Arms, Bushmaster, DPMS/Panther Arms, Marlin, H&R Dakota Arms, Parker, AAC, Barnes Bullets, EOTAC, EOTAC, and Mountain Khakis. Now, these companies that make guns, make ammunition, and make accessories for guns under the Freedom Group, those employees are no longer allowed to bring a gun with them to work, either carry it on themselves or even have it in their vehicle on company property. Now, you explain to me, how is that freedom? You know what this is, guys? This is the lawyers. Chalk it up to decades of lawyers getting in the way and creating some sort of false set of liabilities. That's what you can chalk it up to. You know, I gotta tell you, if I was ever an attorney, I would purposely go into personal injury law. And I would start a law firm that specialized, obviously, in personal injury. And I would actually pull the wool from the eyes of the sheep, and I would actually call the place Ambulance Chasers, and I would advertise it, and I would play up every dirty, filthy thing we all know about the dirty, filthy legal industry and the dirty, filthy people that are involved in it. For the most part, there's a few good attorneys out there, three I think, and they don't practice anymore. Two of them are good friends of mine. So I would call it Ambulance Chasers. I would play the whole thing up, and I'd let them, yeah, we're called the Ambulance Chasers. You guys know us as Ambulance Chasers. We're not trying to pull the wool over your eyes, but let you know, we know what we're doing when it comes to being the Ambulance Chasers. You might actually see one of our vehicles behind your ambulance. God forbid you ever need to be in one from an accident. That's the way I would roll. But Freedom Group is letting their employees know, you can't practice your freedom here. As a matter of fact, you may as well tell them you can't talk about politics when you're at work either, because you're already subverting their Second Amendment right. How about their First Amendment right, you scumbags? Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is live. 1-800-313-9443.
All right, guys, welcome back. I have to tell you, next week I will be in San Diego with Ed Winchester. Last year we did this in August, went down there for about a week, and broadcast right there from the beach, and had an absolutely great time. Some of my fonder memories of doing this radio show. We're down there doing that, and so we'll be doing that next week. Actually, Monday I'll be here in the studio, and then Tuesday through Friday, Ed and I will be broadcasting from the beach, just a little bit south of San Diego in Imperial Beach, literally on the beach in a beach house, which is awesome because that's Ed's wife's place, and get to go down there once or twice a year and hang out, having mimosas for our little morning toast, and it's just going to be fantastic. I have to tell you, to wake up, be able to just walk into the next room, which is nothing but huge windows out to a big beachfront with the surfers out there in the morning, you know, the salt air coming in as we have the windows cracked a little bit, Ed's lovely wife Paula bringing us some mimosas, and you know, just how fantastic is that? So anyhow, that'll be going down next week, and I have to tell you, talk about bated breath. My God, I am so looking forward to this. Gonna take my kids with me. They're gonna be able to go out there and play on the beach and have a great time for their summer break. It's gonna be a lot of fun. So, I want to get into something called Firearms Industry Offers Rebuttal to Anti-Gun Columnist Susan Estrich. Now, this is something I've been sitting on for, I don't know, probably about a week or 10 days. I just haven't gotten to it. So now I'm going to get to it. In her column last week, The Responsibility is Ours, which that wasn't last week. It was on May 25th, 2010. I guess I've been sitting on this for about 3 weeks. Susan Estrich claimed that the crime in Mexico was attributed to, quote, American assault rifles bought at gun stores on the border, and that 80% of the 75,000 assault weapons seized by Mexican authorities were traced back to the United States. That's what she claims. To set the record straight, National Sports Shooting Foundation, NSSF president, Steve Cinetti, submitted his own op-ed piece for publication. Now, in her op-ed piece last week, investigators and regulatory compliance inspections by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, ATF, into firearms trafficking along the southwest border have confirmed that firearms retailers are law-abiding businessmen and women who are playing a key role in detecting and deterring illegal purchases of firearms. Now, illegal by what they're referring to here would be the straw purchases, the straw man purchases, where someone who is able to go in there and pass a background check and buy a gun, goes in there and does that for the purposes of handing it to someone else. Okay, that's a third-party transfer. You can't do that. Furthermore, as part of the Project Gun Runner Impact Team, of course, that's a neat little thing called GRIT. That is a firearms trafficking operation. More than 1,100 firearms retailers were inspected by ATF. Of these 1,100 inspections, only one retailer license was revoked. One. That's less than 0.1%. In addition, ATF investigated more than 1,000 leads and didn't find a single so-called corrupt dealer. Not a single one. Now, turning to the columnist's firearms tracking inaccuracies, she says, according to ATF, some 29,000 firearms were recovered from Mexico in 2008. The most recent year statistics are available. Of these, approximately 5,000 were traced to U.S. sources. That means more than 80% of the firearms recovered in Mexico were not traced to the United States. It would seem Ms. Estrich she's totally screwed up with these total numbers of firearms recovered, 29,000. As opposed to the total number of firearms which were recovered and traced, 5,000. 80% of the total number of recovered firearms versus 80% of the number of recorded and traced firearms is monumentally different. They gave them 5,000 guns to actually trace. Out of the 29,000, 5,000 they gave. Because the interesting thing is, the other 24,000 that were recovered in Mexico the Mexican government knew that they did not come from the U.S. The other 5,000 they knew or suspected came from the U.S. So, of the 29,000, 4,000 came from the U.S. Now, of course, just where Ms. Estrich comes up with the 75,000 assault weapons is dubious, as questionable as how she defines an assault weapon, which means any gun. So she inflated the numbers of 29,000 to 75,000 on her own. And it said 80% of those came from the U.S., which is totally not right. 4,000 guns total. Now, where do those guns come from? We talked about it before. We'll get into it in just a minute. Semi-automatic rifles, demonized as so-called assault weapons, are not machine guns, but modern sport utility rifles, firing one round for every time you press the trigger. Okay. Those rifles that are used every day by law-abiding Americans for shooting sports, hunting, and home protection. Since 2004, when the assault weapons ban expired, modern sporting rifles have fast become one of the more popular types of firearms for law-abiding Americans to purchase. According to the ATF, firearms recovered in Mexico and successfully traced by ATF were originally purchased, originally purchased at retail following a background check on average 14 years ago. This is completely inconsistent with the notion that a flood of newly purchased guns is being illegally smuggled over the border from the United States into Mexico. Now, of course, Miss Estrich, backs the Mexican President Calderon in his attempt to tie drug cartel violence in Mexico to Congress's decision to allow the assault weapons ban to end in 2004. They didn't allow it to end. There was no support for it to continue the 10-year ban. Now, the facts are that the murder rate in Mexico, like the United States, has been steadily decreasing since before 2004. Mexico's murder rate has fallen sharply from a decade ago. The National Public Security System reports that in 2008, the most recent year with available data, 12 people per 100,000 were the victims of murder. In 1997, the number was 17. In the 1980s, the murder rate, however, near 20, according to the National Statistics and Geographic Institute. So, where are cartel-linked firearms coming from? Well, it's well documented that the drug cartels are illegally smuggling fully automatic firearms, grenades, and other weapons into Mexico from South and Central America. Such items are not being purchased at retail firearm stores in the United States. All you have to do is look at the video and the photographs being put out from the U.S. and Mexican government showing all the guns that they collect. I saw something where Greta Van Susteren, why this broad is on Fox News escapes me. She's a leftist pinko, just in filthy ugly at that. Journalist piece of garbage. I mean, are they looking for leftist levity at Fox? I don't get it. She's standing there with the guy, I think his name is David Gomez, who is the U.S. Marshal for Arizona, showing these guns that they have seized on the U.S. side of the border from the Mexican cartels. They're showing 50 caliber rifles. They're showing a Mod Deuce. They're showing M16s, full auto M16. They're showing a number of things. You can get a 50 just about anywhere. You can go almost any gun store, you can get a 50. But the Mod Deuce, the M16s, the MP5s, guys, did those originate in America? The answer is yes. Now, how did they get in the hands of the cartels? They originated in the U.S. However, they were not possessed in the U.S. by U.S. citizens. These guns were built in the United States and sold to other countries, Mexico, Guatemala, wherever. And through corruption, those guns end up in the hands of the Mexican cartels. They're not going across the border. They're going down through the Gulf of Mexico on a container ship into Mexico, where the end user certificates are falsified. And then those corrupt political corruptos ship the guns right off to the cartels, brand new in the cases at some point. And a lot of the people who are joining the Mexican military, I shouldn't say a lot, a percentage, a small percentage of those joining the Mexican military already are on the payroll of the cartels to get the training, get into the Rangers, get into some higher level of training. Once they've got it and they've done some operations, they know what they're doing, they're a cohesive unit, they leave their post and take their guns and ammo with them. Now, these cartels have a fully equipped and operational Ranger unit. Has nothing to do with you and I and our legal ability, our constitutionally protected, God-given rights to go in and buy guns, own and possess guns. Mexican drug cartels and their violence have nothing to do with us exercising our rights. Now, members of the firearm community have long cooperated with the ATF, for example, the NSSF, the Trade Association for the Firearms Industry, has partnered with the ATF for nearly a decade on national campaign to make the public aware that it's a serious crime to straw purchase a firearm. Called Don't Lie for the Other Guy, you've heard about that? Now, Estrich's passion is compelling. Her knowledge of firearms trafficking is not. Diminishing the civil rights of law-abiding Americans will not solve Mexico's crime problem. Neither will misrepresenting stats in our country's newspapers. Stay tuned.
I've been roaming around, always looking down at all I see.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. Right now, the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes.
I have a story that will sicken most of you out of Baltimore, Maryland, right outside of one of the murder capitals of the United States, Washington, D.C., when a former Marine who had his hands raised in the air was shot and killed. An unarmed former Marine was fatally shot by an off-duty Baltimore police officer outside a Mount Vernon bar early Saturday. And he had his hands in the air when the officer fired 13 rounds, striking him 9 times in the chest and groin, according to the police department. Two top police commanders said on Thursday, this is last week, that four witnesses, two of them friends of the victim, Tyrone Brown, and two bystanders corroborated that version of events in taped interviews with homicide detectives and prosecutors that he was unarmed, had his hands in the air when he was shot and killed. The commanders acknowledge that three other witnesses were with Gotti A. Tshamba, said that he, and that is the off-duty cop, Gotti A. Tshamba, said that he identified himself as a police officer, and that Brown shoved Tshamba, events that would be more favorable, obviously, to the officer's case. But police say that their version of events described by those witnesses is that were of the cop and with the cop, his buddies that were there, are inconsistent with the physical evidence recovered at the scene and other findings of the investigation. So they lied. Police sources with knowledge of preliminary autopsy findings say the medical examiner found a heat imprint from a muzzle blast on Brown's shirt, a condition known as stippling. Such an imprint is created when a weapon is fired from as close as 5 inches away. Now, the finding could be used to show that Brown was executed at close range, but it could also indicate that he shot while advancing on the officer. Now, police officials who requested to not be identified, in part to distance themselves for now from what is now a highly sensitive case, have taken the unusual step of releasing details of an investigation as part of an effort to diffuse public anger that Tshamba has not been charged with the crime. He's on paid administrative leave. They say they are frustrated that prosecutors might extend the investigation into the next week or so, delaying the arrest of the 15-year veteran officer. Officials with the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office declined to comment on the investigation. Now, state's attorney Patricia C. Jessamy said during a radio appearance last Thursday that her department was, quote, moving forward expeditiously. Great. Police worry that further delays will add to mounting public suspicion that authorities are protecting one of their own. The unusually harsh criticism, shrouded behind anonymous sources, appears designed to shift public anger over to Shamba's not having been arrested to the prosecutorial arena. Quote, we handed prosecutors our case Monday morning, said one top police official who spoke on the condition he not be named. The lead investigator on the case, quote, has slowly interviewed everyone and went to the crime scene. That's fine, but our position is we would like to proceed as soon as possible. Another commander said, in this case, the best we can see, there is no reason for this man to have been shot as many times as he was. Homicide is convinced that the evidence is very clear. This is not a complex case. There was no physical confrontation. He had his hands up when he was shot. So basically saying he was murdered. The Marine was murdered by the off-duty cop. Speaking with Clarence M. Mitchell IV on WBAL Radio, Jessamy, the state's attorney general, said she planned to meet with prosecutors on Friday, last Friday, to discuss the case, but she cautioned that that doesn't mean charges are imminent. I'm not the general public, Jessamy said. I can't offer opinions. I have to make decisions based on the law, the facts, and the evidence. We will be moving forward expeditiously. Now, despite a swift police investigation, prosecutors say they are awaiting the autopsy report and want to talk with the officers who responded to the scene. They have already re-interviewed the seven witnesses. Privately, officials in the prosecutor's office note that because this is Tshamba's second off-duty shooting of a civilian in 5 years, they want to make sure this case is handled properly. Listen to this. In 2005, Tshamba was driving under the influence of alcohol. He was drunk driving when he got into a confrontation with a group of young men in a sport utility vehicle who, he said, shouted racial epithets at him. Tshamba followed the car, drunk, into a residential neighborhood where the other driver turned his vehicle and rammed the officer. Tshamba chased the men into a wooded area, firing his weapon, and a juvenile, was hit in the foot. Tshamba received an 8-day suspension for the incident, but avoided criminal charges and dismissal. Prosecutors now privately question whether the top police administrators were too lenient in allowing him to remain on the force. As one official said, they expected us to clean up their mess. Can you believe this? He was driving drunk, pursued them into an accident, chased them into the woods, and shot a kid. And he got 8 days off work instead of being thrown in prison? A civilian would have been thrown in prison. Hang this guy. Hang this guy by his own crimes. Stay tuned, guys. More to come after the break.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Gun control, loved by dictators since 1917. The two-way radio show with Bill Carnes is back. 1-800-313-9443.
All right. I reported to you guys, I don't know, 4 months ago probably, that the state of New Hampshire was looking at doing their own Firearms Freedom Act, and their unique spin on the proposed legislation for the New Hampshire Firearms Freedom Act was this. If any state or local official attempted to enforce a federal statute on a state firearm or state item based on the Firearms Freedom Act, if they tried to enforce a federal law on a state gun or item, they would be guilty of a misdemeanor. And if any federal officer tried to enforce a federal statute on a what was clearly a state gun, a state Firearms Freedom Act gun or item. That federal official, cop, ATF agent, FBI, whomever, would be guilty of a felony. And all of these crimes carried jail time, prison time, if it was a felony. There's a difference between jail and prison. Jail is where you go when you get arrested by the cops. Prison is where you go if you're convicted of a felony. Much different. So the federal officer would be convicted of a felony and probably have to pay a fine as well. So very cool. Now, what they've done is something else which is unbelievable, really. This was posted, I just got this today, but this was posted about 11 days ago on the 6th. It says the New Hampshire state legislature took an unbelievably bold step last Monday, a week ago Monday, by introducing a resolution to declare certain actions by the federal government to completely, totally void. These different actions would be totally void, and warning that certain future acts will be viewed as, quote, a breach of peace with the states themselves that, quote, risks nullifying the Constitution. Now, this act by New Hampshire is a clear warning to the federal government that they could face being stripped of their powers by the states, presumably through civil war, if the federal government would not necessarily see and recognize the 10th Amendment rights of New Hampshire. The remarkable document outlines with perfect clarity some basics long forgotten. For instance, it reminds Congress that, quote, that the Constitution of the United States, having delegated to Congress a power to punish treason, counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States, piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the law of nations, slavery, and no other crime whatsoever. Therefore, all acts of Congress which assume to create, define, or punish crimes other than those enumerated in the Constitution are altogether void and of no force. You get that? That means all of these different crimes that people have been convicted of from federal law, if they were not included in what I just stated, which came from the Constitution, they're void. And nobody seems to argue those on the federal level, on the constitutional level. Now, that would mean federal gun crimes, void. Federal drug crimes, void. All other federal criminal laws that deal with anything other than the specific enumerated crimes, all void. Now, one would think that if any lawyer anywhere in the entire country was worth their salt, all federal criminal trials would have ended years ago. This seems to prove that most lawyers are dullards. New Hampshire deals a complete death blow to the pending federal hate crimes legislation by pointing out, quote, that therefore all acts of Congress of the United States which do abridge the freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press are not law but are altogether void and of no force. Later in the resolution, New Hampshire makes clear what the feds are now risking if they proceed further. The removal of all powers from the federal government by the states. Quoting directly from the resolution, here we go. That any act by the Congress of the United States, executive order of the President of the United States of America, or judicial order by the judiciaries of the United States of America, which assumes a power not delegated to the government of the United States of America by the Constitution for the United States of America, and which serves to diminish the liberty of any of the several states or their citizens, shall constitute a nullification of the Constitution for the United States of America by the government of the United States of America. Acts which would cause a nullification include, but are not limited to, 1. Establishing martial law or a state of emergency within one of the states compromising the United States of America without the consent of the legislature of that state. 2. Requiring voluntary servitude or governmental service other than a draft during a declared war, or pursuant to, or as an alternative to, incarceration after due process of law. 3. Requiring involuntary servitude or governmental service of persons under the age of 18, other than pursuant to, or as an alternative to, incarceration after due process of law. 4. Surrendering any power delegated or not delegated to any corporation or foreign government. 5. Any act regarding religion, further limitations on freedom of political speech, or further limitations on freedom of the press. 6. Further infringement on the right to keep and bear arms, including prohibitions of types or quantity of ammunition or arms, arms or ammunition, and that should any act of Congress become law or executive order or judicial order be put into force, all powers previously delegated to the United States of America by the Constitution for the United States shall revert to the several states individually. Any future government of the United States of America shall require ratification of 3/4 of the states seeking a form of government of the United States of America and shall be binding upon any state not seeking to form such a government. Shall not be binding upon any state not seeking such form of a government. And that copies of this resolution be transmitted by the House Clerk to the President of the United States, each member of the United States Congress, and the presiding officers of each state's legislature. Isn't this awesome? The enforcement proposal follows. We have followed with great interest the debate over the Arizona immigration law. If those who are speaking out truly understood the provisions of our Constitution, we may have a more informed debate. It's obvious that most of the public has no concept or knowledge of what the Constitution really says. The only place in the federal Constitution that any law enforcement powers are granted is in Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 15, where the law enforcement powers are granted to the militia. Congress is given the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. There are no other law enforcement powers granted anywhere else in the Constitution. The world's police, marshal, agent, sheriff, prosecutor, or any form of them do not appear anywhere in the Constitution. The militias belong to the states, and the next paragraph states that the federal government is to see that the militias are armed, but the states are responsible for the training and appointment of officers. Most states' constitutions say the same thing as the federal constitution. The militia is to be called upon to execute the laws of the state to suppress insurrections and repel invasions. One more point. The National Guard is not the militia. The militia is defined as able-bodied men between ages of 18 and up. The top age varies according to the various state constitutions. Neither the National Guard nor any organized police power in the federal government or any of the several states' governments can lawfully claim to be militia. They can't. Besides that, the National Guard was founded in the early 1900s. The Constitution was ratified in the 1700s. The National Guard didn't exist. It was the militia. The state's constitutions say words to the following effect. The governor shall be commander-in-chief of the military forces of the state, except when they shall be called into service of the United States. He shall have power to call out the militia to execute the laws, to suppress insurrections, or to repel invasion. If Arizona had used the powers in the federal constitution and the Arizona constitution simply called out the militia, there'd be no room for any argument. Except some may contend that the influx of illegal aliens is not an invasion. Now here's the crux of the matter. The federal constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 16, requires the federal government to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers, and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. Clearly, the militia belongs to the states. The states have the power to appoint the officers and train the men. Obviously, we think that, in the view of our enlightened age we now live in, the militia should be able-bodied men and women between the ages of, say, 18 and 65. Once the governor has restored the militia, then the states need to turn to the federal government and demand the arms required to be distributed to all able-bodied men and women in the state and that they immediately be provided, as well as all the ammo. That should end all discussion about gun laws and give the state an army to defend itself from invasion of its sovereign territory. I gotta tell you, I absolutely love this. Absolutely love it. There is a, somewhere on here. Do I have it? No. I thought I had the link to be able to read the entire, I don't have it on here. I don't have it somewhere. I had the link to be able to read the entire provision of this. I will find it. Now, to be able to tell the federal government to go pound sand because we the people are the militia and we are regulated by the state. The governor is the chief commanding officer, right? And you're there to enforce the laws of the state, stop insurrection, and repel invasion. And if there happens to be some sort of invasion attempted against the United States, at the request of the federal government, the state governors can say, okay, we're going to loan you to the federal government because there's a problem that involves all of the states, and all the states are coming together united for the well-being of all the states, hence the United States. Imagine that. So what we now have is we have these states that have these legislators that are very bright. And they're letting the government, you know what? Over the last couple of hundreds of years, you have really gotten out of control. You've enumerated yourself so much power and authority, and it's illegal. It is against the Constitution. This is the mother document. It started with the Declaration of Independence, right? The Constitution of the United States does not void any, it doesn't, okay, well, the Constitution is newer, so the Declaration of Independence is now void. Constitution took over. That's not the case. The Declaration of Independence still stands at its face value under the interpretation of what it meant at the time it was written by the men who wrote and signed it. That is the only way to interpret the Declaration of Independence. Likewise, it's the only way to interpret the Constitution of the United States. Those of you who would believe that the Constitution of the United States is a living, breathing document have never read it. Your sick liberal fantasy is that, oh, we should be able to reinterpret provisions of the Constitution based on society and how we're feeling. Well, that's a knee-jerk reaction. Have you ever noticed that every piece of knee-jerk legislation that has ever been passed, later, people look at it and say, yeah, we shouldn't have done that. That should be repealed or allow it to sunset. Every single time. Now you want to take the mother document of the land, the Constitution, and make it living and breathing? So that you can reinterpret it on a whim and pass all kinds of legislation? The legislation itself is bad enough. Now you want to reinterpret the guiding document. No, I don't think so. The only way that you can ever legitimately interpret the Constitution is to interpret that wonderful document, Constitution of the United States, as it was meant to be interpreted by the men who wrote it at the time it was written. That's it. There's no other way to do it. Which means, in the Second Amendment, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's the last half of the amendment. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's infringed upon. Look at the National Firearms Act of 1934, the aptly named Gun Control Act of 1968, and the name which totally reverses what it is, the Gun Owners Protection Act of 1986. You didn't protect anything. All that stuff is null and void because it is unconstitutional. You get it? And if the Supreme Court rules that something is constitutional, when in fact the strict interpretation of the Constitution would show that it is not, because they believe that certain laws make sense. Well, the thing is the Supreme Court is then saying, all right, well, these federal laws make sense, so we're gonna go ahead and adjudicate this Supreme Court decision based on the Constitution within the ideas that these other laws on the federal books make sense. But those federal laws themselves are unconstitutional because the government didn't have the authority to make them. Isn't that great? Guys, stay tuned. I got more after the break. You're listening to me, your host, Bill Carnes, right here on 2A Radio.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Back off, I'll take you on. Headstrong to take on anyone. I know that you are wrong if this is not where you belong.
All right, welcome back. So a request has come out. What is the latest with the McDonald versus Chicago case at the Supreme Court? McDonald versus Chicago was a case that was enacted after the D.C. versus Heller decision that came out this time last year. It came out June 26, 2008, that struck down the handgun ban and most of the other gun laws in Washington, D.C. is unconstitutional. Now, what has the D.C. City Council done? They've passed other laws which really are in violation. They're in contempt of court, of the Supreme Court's ruling is what they are. But they've passed laws that would allow people to have guns, and they put in an administrative provision to be able to, like this, this path you have to go to in order to, be able to get guns. So they've enacted that to try to be within the provisions of the Supreme Court's ruling. But the thing is they have not given the authority to anybody within the administrative chain to do anything with it or actually sign off and say, okay, you can have a gun. So then they're calling it an administrative hurdle that they need to deal with, right? That's their excuse. They're in contempt of court. They should all be thrown in federal prison until they can get their act together. Or just have the House just completely strip any and all authority from the authority that they've given to the City Council in D.C. Anyhow, in Chicago, you have McDonald versus Chicago. Clarence McDonald, I believe that's his name. It was Clarence? I believe it was his first name. Who's one guy, along with three or four other citizens of Chicago, that along with the Second Amendment Foundation, filed suit against Chicago because they want to be able to keep handguns in their house for self-protection and even be able to carry them. And Chicago has an outright ban, total outright ban on all handguns in the city, unless you're a cop. Or, I guess if you're a criminal and you don't want to follow the law, which is what happens and why their murder rate is so blooming high. So, on March 2nd of this year, 2010, oral arguments were heard at the Supreme Court because this case was going through all of the courts and Chicago kept getting their asses handed to them by all the court. Yeah, it's unconstitutional. You can't do it. Yeah, it's unconstitutional. You can't. So they kept appealing this to a higher court and a higher court. Finally, Supreme Court heard it and they said during the oral arguments, look, why is this case here? Why are you ignoring the Heller case, the Heller decision? Well, Second Amendment's never been incorporated to the states through the 14th Amendment. They say, it doesn't need to be. The Second Amendment existed before the 14th Amendment did not erase the Second Amendment. Your original class citizens already have their Second Amendment. What are you doing here? So sometime this month, the McDonald versus Chicago case is scheduled to be read and adjudicated this month, June 2010. It is the 17th of the month. We have less than 2 weeks left to wait. That is the update on McDonald v. Chicago. Hopefully, we'll have a ruling out by sometime this time next week. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you. In Congress, the executive and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule. Stay tuned for the Control Factor
tomorrow. Will your freedoms? The Two-Way Radio Show, 7 a.m. Pacific, 9 Central, Monday through Friday.